Chapter 25. Intellectual powers, your immortal interests, perhaps, depend on the choice of this moment. There is the door, and the key is in my hand. Choose, choose. And how comes the key in your hand? And what is the condition of my liberation? Said Stanton. The explanation occupied several pages, which, to the torture of young Melmoth, were wholly illegible. It seemed, however, to have been rejected by Stanton with the utmost rage and horror, for Melmoth at last made out, "Beggin, monster, demon, beggin to your native place. Even this mansion of horror trembles to contain you, its walls sweat, and its floors quiver, while you tread them." The conclusion of this extraordinary manuscript was in such a state that, in 15 moldy and crumbling pages, Melmoth could hardly make out that number of lines. No antiquarian, unfolding with trembling hand the calcined leaves of an Herculaneum manuscript, and hoping to discover some lost lines of the Aeneis in Virgil's own autograph, or at least some unutterable abomination of Petronius or Martial, happily elucidatory of the mysteries of the spintree, or the orgies of the phallic worshippers, ever pored with more luckless diligence, or shook a head of more hopeless despondency over his task. He could but just make out what tended rather to excite than assuage that feverish thirst of curiosity which was consuming his inmost soul. The manuscript told no more of Melmoth, but mentioned that Stanton was finally liberated from his confinement, that his pursuit of Melmoth was incessant and indefatigable, that he himself allowed it to be a species of insanity, that while he acknowledged it to be the master passion, he also felt it the master torment of his life. He again visited the continent, returned to England, pursued, inquired, traced, bribed, but in vain. The being whom he had met thrice, under circumstances so extraordinary, he was fated never to encounter again in his lifetime. At length, discovering that he had been born in Ireland, he resolved to go there, went, and found his pursuit again fruitless, and his inquiries unanswered. The family knew nothing of him, or at least what they knew or imagined, they prudently refused to disclose to a stranger, and Stanton departed unsatisfied. It is remarkable that he too, as appeared from many half-obliterated pages of the manuscript, never disclosed to mortal the particulars of their conversation in the madhouse, and the slightest allusion to it threw him into fits of rage and gloom equally singular and alarming. He left the manuscript, however, in the hands of the family, possibly deeming, from their incuriosity, their apparent indifference to their relative, or their obvious unacquaintance with reading of any kind, manuscript or books, his deposit would be safe. He seems, in fact, to have acted like men who, in distress at sea, entrust their letters and dispatches to a bottle sealed, and commit it to the waves. The last lines of the manuscript that were legible were sufficiently extraordinary. I have sought him everywhere. The desire of meeting him once more has become as a burning fire within me. It is the necessary condition of my existence. I have vainly sought him at last in Ireland, of which I find he is a native. Perhaps our final meeting will be in. Such was the conclusion of the manuscript which Melmoth found in his uncle's closet. When he had finished it, he sunk down on the table near which he had been reading it, his face hid in his folded arms, his senses reeling, his mind in a mingled state of stupor and excitement. After a few moments, he raised himself with an involuntary start, and saw the picture gazing at him from its canvas. He was within 10 inches of it as he sat, and the proximity appeared increased by the strong light that was accidentally thrown on it, and its being the only representation of a human figure in the room. Melmoth felt for a moment as if he were about to receive an explanation from its lips. He gazed on it in return. All was silent in the house. They were alone together. The illusion subsided at length. And as the mind rapidly passes to opposite extremes, he remembered the injunction of his uncle to destroy the portrait. He seized it. His hand shook at first, but the moldering canvas appeared to assist him in the effort. He tore it from the frame with a cry half terrific, half triumphant. It fell at his feet, and he shuddered as it fell. He expected to hear some fearful sounds, some unimaginable breathings of prophetic horror, follow this act of sacrilege, for such he felt it, to tear the portrait of his ancestor from his native walls. He paused and listened. There was no voice, nor any that answered. But as the wrinkled and torn canvas fell to the floor, its undulations gave the portrait the appearance of smiling. Melmoth felt horror indescribable at this transient and imaginary resuscitation of the figure. He caught it up, rushed into the next room, tore, cut, and hacked it in every direction, and eagerly watched the fragments that burned like tinder in the turf fire which had been lit in his room. As Melmoth saw the last blaze, he threw himself into bed, in hope of a deep and intense sleep. He had done what was required of him, and felt exhausted both in mind and body, but his slumber was not so sound as he had hoped for. The sullen light of the turf fire, burning but never blazing, disturbed him every moment. He turned and turned, but still there was the same red light glaring on, but not illuminating, the dusky furniture of the apartment. The wind was high that night, and as the creaking door swung on its hinges, every noise seemed like the sound of a hand struggling with the lock, or of a foot pausing on the threshold. But, for Melmoth never could decide, was it in a dream or not, that he saw the figure of his ancestor appear at the door, hesitatingly as he saw him at first on the night of his uncle's death, saw him enter the room, approach his bed, and heard him whisper, "You have burned me, then. But those are flames I can survive. I am alive, I am beside you." Melmoth started, sprung from his bed. It was broad daylight. He looked round. There was no human being in the room but himself. He felt a slight pain in the wrist of his right arm. He looked at it. It was black and blue, as from the recent gripe of a strong hand. Balzac's tale, Melmoth reconciled, in vol. 4. Furnishes a solution to the terrible problem which Maturin has stated in this story. Editor's note. Introduction to A Mystery with a Moral. The next mystery story is like no other in these volumes. The editor's defense lies in the plea that Lawrence Sterne is not like other writers of English. He is certainly one of the very greatest. Yet nowadays he is generally unknown. His rollicking frankness, his audacious unconventionality, are enough to account for the neglect. Even the easy-mannered England of 1760 opened its eyes in horror when Tristram Shandy appeared. A most unclerical clergyman, the public pronounced the rector of Sutton and prebendary of York. Besides, his style was rambling to the last degree. Plot concerned him least of all authors of fiction. For instance, it is more than doubtful that the whimsical parson really intended a moral to be read into the adventures of his sentimental journey that follow in these pages. He used to declare that he never intended anything. He never knew whither his pen was leading the rash implement, once in hand, was likely to fly with him from Yorkshire to Italy, or to Paris, or across the road to Uncle Toby's. And what could the helpless author do but improve each occasion? So here is one such occasion thus improved by disjointed sequels heedless, one would say, and yet glittering with the unreturnable thrust of subtle wit, or softening with simple emotion, like a thousand immortal passages of this random philosopher. Even the slightest turns of Sterne's pen bear inspiration. No less a critic than the severe Hazlitt was satisfied that his works consist only of brilliant passages. And because the editors of the present volumes found added to the mystery not only a solution, but an application of worldly wisdom, and a contrast in Sterne's best vein of quiet happiness, they have felt emboldened to ascribe the passage A Mystery with a Moral. As regards the application, Sterne knew whereof he wrote. He sought the south of France for health in 1762, and was run after and feted by the most brilliant circles of Parisian literateurs. This foreign sojourn failed to cure his lung complaint, but suggested the idea to him of the rambling and charming sentimental journey. Only 3 weeks after its publication, on March 18, 1768, Sterne died alone in his London lodgings. Spite of all that marred his genius, his work has lived and will live, if only for the exquisite literary art which ever made great things out of little. The editor. Lawrence Sterne, A Mystery with a Moral, Parisian Experience of Parson Yorick, On His Sentimental Journey, A Riddle, I remained at the gate of the hotel for some time, looking at everyone who passed by, and forming conjectures upon them, till my attention got fixed upon a single object, which confounded all kind of reasoning upon him. It was a tall figure of a philosophic, serious adult look, which passed and repassed sedately along the street, making a turn of about 60 paces on each side of the gate of the hotel. The man was about 52, had a small cane under his arm, was dressed in a dark drab-colored coat, waistcoat, and breeches, which seemed to have seen some years' service. They were still clean, and there was a little air of frugal propriety throughout him. By his pulling off his hat, and his attitude of accosting a good many in his way, I saw he was asking charity, so I got a sous or two out of my pocket, ready to give him as he took me in his turn. He passed by me without asking anything, and yet he did not go 5 steps farther, before he asked charity of a little woman. I was much more likely to have given of the two. He had scarce done with the woman, when he pulled his hat off to another who was coming the same way. An ancient gentleman came slowly, and after him a young smart one. He let them both pass and asked nothing. I stood observing him half an hour, in which time he had made a dozen turns backward and forward, and found that he invariably pursued the same plan. There were two things very singular in this which set my brain to work, and to no purpose. The first was, why the man should only tell his story to the sex, and secondly, what kind of a story it was, and what species of eloquence it could be which softened the hearts of the women which he knew it was to no purpose, to practice upon the men. There were two other circumstances which entangled this mystery. The one was, he told every woman what he had to say in her ear, and in a way which had much more the air of a secret than a petition. The other was, it was always successful. He never stopped a woman, but she pulled out her purse and immediately gave him something. I could form no system to explain the phenomenon. I had got a riddle to amuse me for the rest of the evening, so I walked upstairs to my chamber. Overheard, the man who either disdains or fears to walk up a dark entry may be an excellent, good man, and fit for 100 things. But he will not do to make a sentimental traveler. I count little of the many things I see pass at broad noonday, in large and open streets. Nature is shy, and hates to act before spectators. But in such an unobservable corner you sometimes see a single short scene of hers worth all the sentiments of a dozen French plays compounded together. And yet they are absolutely fine, and whenever I have a more brilliant affair upon my hands than common, as they suit a preacher just as well as a hero, I generally make my sermon out of them, and for the text, Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, Phrygia, and Pamphylia, is as good as anyone in the Bible. There is a long, dark passage issuing out from the Opera Comique into a narrow street. It is trod by a few who humbly wait for facre asterisk or wish to get off quietly o foot, when the opera is done. At the end of it, toward the theater, 'tis lighted by a small candle, the light of which is almost lost before you get halfway down, but near the door it is more for ornament than use. You see it as a fixed star of the least magnitude. It burns, but does little good to the world, that we know of. Asterisk Hackney Coach. In returning from the opera along this passage, I discerned, as I approached within 5 or 6 paces of the door, 2 ladies standing arm in arm with their backs against the wall, waiting, as I imagined, for a fiacre. As they were next to the door, I thought they had a prior right, so I etched myself up within a yard or little more of them, and quietly took my stand. I was in black and scarce seen. The lady next to me was a tall, lean figure of a woman of about 36, the other, of the same size and make of about 40. There was no mark of wife or widow in any one part of either of them. They seemed to be 2 upright vestal sisters, unsapped by caresses, unbroken upon by tender salutations. I could have wished to have made them happy. Their happiness was destined, that night, to come from another quarter. A low voice with a good turn of expression, and sweet cadence at the end of it, begged for a 12 sous piece between them for the love of heaven. I thought it singular that a beggar should fix the quota of an alms, and that the sum should be 12 times as much as what is usually given in the dark. They both seemed astonished at it as much as myself. 12 sous, said one. A 12 sous piece, said the other, and made no reply. The poor man said he knew not how to ask less of ladies of their rank, and bowed down his head to the ground. Pooh, said they, we have no money. The beggar remained silent for a moment or two, and renewed his supplication. Do not, my fair young ladies, said he, stop your good ears against me. Upon my word, honest man, said the younger, we have no change. Then God bless you, said the poor man, and multiply those joys which you can give to others without change. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.